It's been quite a while since I've released a midweek miracle episode, but here we are. It's the season of giving, and this episode is so perfect for this time of year. My guest, John David Graham, has really led an unconventional life, and as you'll hear, is a witness to many of the events that took place in the last century. So speaking of giving and this time of year, John has really, really centered his life around doing good for others. And what does that look like? How can he do it? How can he step into it? How can he be someone that lifts others up? Well, as the interview progresses, you'll hear all of those stories, but particularly I want to just let you know that John is the founder of Good Samaritan Home, which is a housing and mentoring program that helps men and women restart their lives after prison. John's done so many things. He's been a door-to-door salesman, a children's home counselor, a substitute school teacher, truck driver, fireman, building contractor, minister, and journalist, among many other vocations. He truly is a chameleon and inhabits each of these roles and has inhabited each of these roles with a whole lot of grace. He has lots of life experience. He's an incredible human being. He has lots and lots of anecdotes and stories. And you know how I love me a good story. And so with that introduction, and without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to John David Graham.
We had a man who came to us in 2009 or so, one of our first residents, and he was already, I think he was 67 years old, and he was schizophrenic, so he had issues. Plus, he had legal issues, and he was in and out of our houses, and he stayed by and large for 14 years with us because he was, when he came to us the last time, he was on the street, freezing and near death because he had nowhere to go, and he stayed with us for 14 years. And when he eventually died, at one point he told us this was the only home he ever had.
As a human being, if you had to go somewhere and introduce yourself, how would you do that?
I would say there's one word that encapsulizes my 76 years. It's curious. I'm always looking for something new.
I love that. And I've said this so many times on this podcast that curiosity is a superpower because I think it keeps you excited about life and it keeps you excited about learning. And also, it's a good reason to wake up in the morning learning something new. You've had quite the roller coaster of a life. You're laughing. For those of you who can't see, John is laughing. And so I guess, you know, when you were a kid, what was your idea of what your life was going to look like?
I grew up in the small mill town surrounding Pittsburgh in the 50s. So everything was very structured and very working class. And this whole concept of family that we have today, particularly the fathers being involved as they are today, was just foreign. Your father went to the mill. He came home at night and then he went to the bar and he came home, went to bed, and that's it. So I was raised in a very conservative structure, though, with my mother, and I had planned to be a minister. So when I went to college, I started asking questions that I couldn't get answers in my structured past. And religion is actually back in the news again today with the fundamentalist evangelicals. And so I graduated college with more questions than I had answers. And that curiosity just about killed the cat.
Yes, it can sometimes do that. I was going to ask if, I mean, at the end of your college journey, were you a bit at sea? Were you thinking, oh, my goodness, what do I do now? I mean, how did you tackle that?
That's exactly. Of course, we had the Vietnam issue and we had the draft. And so I did alternative service in lieu of the draft. I was considered at the time a conscientious objector, but you had an obligation to the government to do alternative service. So I worked in an orphanage in Detroit and I spent my 2 years there. And so I was a house manager slash counselor. And at one point I thought, now I can go teaching in the inner city, but that would have required another 4 years of college. And so I ended up driving a truck. And then I was a fireman. And then I was a building contractor. And then I was we had moved through three states with the building business, ended up in Texas. And then I decided I'm going to go back to school to teach. So I came back north and ended up the only place I could teach. I tried being a minister again, thinking I could teach in the church. But what I found was coming out of the 60s in Vietnam, we came through all the protests. In fact, I was at Kent State the day of the killings. But the caveat, I was not in the protest there. I had missed it and gone on to Ohio State that same day, got involved in a protest at Ohio State with all the news coming around about the four students dead. The guards surrounded us. They were pointing guns at us. But fortunately, calmer heads, clearer heads prevailed. But I came out of that totally skewed politically. And I guess you could say I came out uncivilized because I lost all respect for the structures that we grew up with. So when I tried to be a minister again, I didn't do well because there's a certain degree of politics involved. There's a certain degree of civilization. I think many times the minister is a good luck charm. You rub them on the head and say, pray for me, wish me well, but don't tell me no. And so I ended up leaving there and becoming a journalist. And there I learned to appreciate the government, not the government politically, but the bureaucracy of hardworking functionaries. And that was the first time I voted after Kent State. 30 years it took me to vote. And so that long journey. And during that time, I had actually been homeless before I was married. So what I came out of it with it, all these mistakes, I guess you can call them, or missteps, that my wife and I decided, what can we do to help people who have gone through what we've gone through? And that's when we bought an old house with my background in construction and remodeled it as a homeless shelter. And that was the beginning of our real journey. And that was 24 years ago.
Wow, I have so many questions.
Fire away.
Well, you know, I guess, of course, I know about the Vietnam War. Of course, I know about conscientious objectors. I did not know that in lieu of going, you could go do this other service. So did you get to choose working in the orphanage, or did they kind of match you up with where it was appropriate?
Well, you have to apply. You can't just do it. And I was rejected, and they said, well, you'll have to go into the Army. And I appealed the process, went through the whole legal issue. And it's hard to explain now, but the issue was so contentious back in 1968 and 1970. The country was literally coming apart over Vietnam. And the closest thing I can bring it to is probably January 6th. The difference is, instead of attacking the Capitol, we attacked every college campus in the country. And there were draft boards attacked. So it was extremely hostile. And Kent State was the culmination. So I appealed and they approved, but I had to pick a place and then they had to approve it. So there was a process. So it's not something you'd simply say, I'm not going to do it. It's not where you avoid the draft. You do an alternative that's based on a commitment within a legitimate field.
And I have to say that, honestly, you know, you had this idea of becoming a minister, and to be quite honest, being of service in that orphanage, at least to me, is a form of ministry, because I can't even imagine being present for those kids, doing the counseling, you know, being someone who's there that they know they can count on, who will show up for them. For me, I think that's a kind of ministry. And it's so it kind of dovetails for me. It's really beautiful, the idea that you kind of live that out a little bit.
Hearing you talk, what comes to my mind is that the orphanage was a precursor for what we're doing now, because I define what we're doing with Good Samaritan Home, which is the nonprofit I founded. It's the faith lived in the street, not by telling you what I believe, not by saying, are you saved? What I ask is, are you hungry? And I believe that that's the question that people hear, because it's a language they understand. So I would, in fact, I would even go so far as to suggest that the church today has lost that type of conversation. They're pointing fingers now instead of holding out empty hands saying, let me help you up.
Yeah, I agree. I want to say thank you for your work in that orphanage, because I suspect that many days it was not easy. And then going, you know, talking about Kent State and what happened there, I mean, we've all been brought up with this idea that, or this belief, I guess you could say, that we all have a right to speak our minds, and that what we say, you know, is legitimate, that you can't censor speech. You cannot censor what people have to say. And that's what those students were doing. They were protesting and saying, we don't agree with the route, the tack the country is going. We don't agree with the killing of innocent people. And so to speak up like that and have your voice heard, and then have your government come in and just kill you when you're practicing your First Amendment rights. I mean, it just seems really antithetical and confusing, and also scary, incredibly scary.
Now, I will say this, that I have found over my years that fundamentalism exists on the left and the right. There was Stokely Carmichael was as violent as Bull Connor on the other end of the spectrum, perhaps justified in some eyes, but still violent. So I was schooled under Dr. King's approach that, and then now Nelson Mandela, that the idea that only love or service can win somebody to your cause, not your doctrines, not your fists, not your violence. And the protesters, from what I remember, were just as provocateur as the guard was. The guard was, I'm not excusing them, because the politics covered a lot of Kent State. And many people in Ohio at the time said they were glad those students were killed because they were commies. And that's not true. They weren't commies. Although my understanding also is that there was a communist element at that time. We just, the idea was, if we can infiltrate and provoke middle America, farm America, then we can provoke the whole country. But what happened was it scared the hell out of us when the students were shot. And we literally thought we were going to lose it.
Gosh. And then, I mean, I just find it fascinating that you then went on to journalism.
Yeah. Yeah. Different type of provocateur.
Now, was there a specific type of journalism that you practiced? How did you get involved in it?
I was hungry. I needed a job. But I've been writing a column for the newspaper, because I've been doing journaling all my life. And I find that journaling for me is my, I call it cheap therapy. You get your thoughts out. And I recommend that to anybody who needs the listening ear. Write in your journal, because you can listen to you very well in notes. So I had fun writing. So I had to learn how to be a journalist. And the idea is, you just get the facts, don't give an opinion, and just present them. This was back in the day when that was actually the credo. Today, I'm not convinced that all journalists, particularly on television, are doing that, or on the podcast. But there's In fact, that's what concerns me more than anything else, is that we look at the news today and say, if I don't agree with it, it's not true. I don't believe it. And that basic disrespect for the media, for and the bias of some in the media has made what we're doing now all plausible and more frightening than ever, I believe.
I agree with that. I mean, we all know the term gaslighting. And, you know, when you have an experience in your life, no matter whether it has to do with politics or with a friend or with family, and the person that you're having, you know, this kind of contentious engagement with says, oh, no, you completely don't even understand what happened. That isn't actually what happened. It starts to make you feel like you have no concept of reality. And I think that we all experience the world in different ways. We all experience based on our pasts, based on what we've gone through, the prejudices that we might have. But there is, I mean, I firmly believe that at the very bottom of everything, there is a fundamental layer of truthfulness, of reality, of what's actually going on. And I agree, it's really challenging today to be an informed participant in the world, because right. invariably you're going to run up against someone that says, oh, no, you have no idea what you're talking about. That none of what you're saying is true. And so it's really, I mean, my God, I'm 53 years old, and this is the most challenging time for just engaging in civil dialogue with others that I've ever seen. And I so wish that we could do that as a, you know, a country.
You're just young enough to have missed, because in the 68 is considered the fulcrum where the country tipped into a new era. It was going to go, we thought we were going to come apart. The politics started changing in 64. It became more violent rhetoric and tribal, as they call it. But it dissipated. I think Kent State scared us, and we came back from the brink. And Jimmy Carter came in with a whole different attitude. And I think he's probably one of the finest men I've ever come across. Although as a president, he probably struggled more because nice guys don't seem to do well in Washington. It's a meat grinder. And Ronald Reagan just made us feel good. And we're learning that there were things we didn't know about. But all that to say that I see a circle, it's cyclical. And if you go backwards, if you go back to 1936, I saw the same cycle towards authoritarianism. And then you go back in 1870, there's the same trend. So all that to say, I believe we'll get through this. But I believe there will be consequences, and we may lose a generation to skeptics, to skepticism, I'm afraid.
Well, I love people who are hopeful. So already I like you. I like you a lot because I inherently believe in humanity. You know, at the end of the day, I've certainly met people that I don't agree with politically, and I like them. You know, I like them as people. We don't all have to agree on everything. I would just like it if we didn't visit violence, whether it's through words or actions on others. That's my wish. I wanted to ask to go back to your childhood, because my second question always is, did you grow up in a religious household? And I'm curious about how that tied into your decision to go into ministry later on.
My mother, and I identified with her, although we were not a close family. In fact, in my novel, I use that my family as a model. And the phrase I used was, we lived in the same house. We had the same last name. We ate at the same table, but we were strangers. We all lived alone together. And for me, the fundamentalism of the Christian faith gave me structure and meaning at that time. And then when I started questioning that, then my whole structure was in that belief, that doctrinal system. And so when that fell apart, everything fell apart. And that's unfortunately, when you have nothing, no supports underneath your doctrines, no stability. When your doctrines fail, then everything falls out. And that's what happened to me. But I have concluded, to be on the optimistic side, I've come back to conclude that I don't have the same fundamentalist belief, but I still believe in an ordered, designed universe. I believe there's meaning and purpose. And the word for God has many different names, and I'm very open to that because I wouldn't dare say that my definition is yours. But your definition and my definition should help us make the world a little better. And if it doesn't, then I would question that.
Now I like you even more.
Yeah.
I have to say that one of the first things I tell myself, and I try to say it every day, is that I know nothing. Especially when it comes to the idea of the divine, I know nothing. I can suspect, I can guess, I can suppose, I could even be a little curious and read up about other people's ideas of what that source looks like or that energy looks like. But it's so fantastical and beyond anything that we as humans can even imagine. And so I remind myself every day, I can have my ideas. I can have my supposes, but in the end, they're mine. And my experiences are different than yours, different than other people's. And for me personally, I think there is something incredibly gorgeous about a multiplicity of ideas and conceptions of the divine, and also experiences of the divine, because that means the divine, for me at least, is super groovy and has many different ways of meeting us where we are.
Right. Do you remember that movie Rudy? Well, he went to the priest, and he was his mentor priest at Notre Dame, and he was so upset, and he was even questioning his faith because he kept getting denied his dream of getting into Notre Dame. And he said, I'm even doubting my faith. And the priest said, in all my years, I've only come to two very clear conclusions. Number one, there is a God. And number two, that God is not me. and I think that sums it up, is that we are looking for God to be our genie, to fix us, make everything perfect, to be happy, to be the Prince Charming that's going to make my life easy. But I've found that just the opposite. You want patience, that means you get a lot of stuff coming in your way. So you earn patience.
I loved that movie. I just want to put that out there. It is so sweet. So sweet. And, you know, sometimes whenever my heart needs a boost to feel good about the world, I'll find a movie. And sometimes it's Rudy that I watch that reaffirms my faith in humanity or the potentialities that we all have. I've started discovering that, you know, just like my body needs to eat and have sustenance to feed it and nourish it, my heart also needs nourishment. And what does that look like? Where do I find that nourishment? How does it make me happy or help, you know, make me feel sad or what have you? So that's been something I've been kind of checking out the last 2 months. I wanted to ask, you are such a dynamic, imaginative, compassionate,
I'm sorry, did somebody else walk in the room here?
empathetic. And as you said, curious human being. And yet you grew up in this town that was a mill town, where I can imagine those attributes were not fostered or kind of cultivated, maybe in your household, in the community. How did you manage to navigate that and make it through?
Just going beyond my particular household, I've learned and I'm learning that it was actually much more common among my milieu, my working class group, where we existed. We grew up in homes where you were just expected to go through, get through high school and get into the mill, get a job, get a family, spend your nights at the bar, and then retire and maybe go to Florida if you're lucky. Mostly you just went to the Steelers games on Sunday. So But what I've found is that there were others out there that I didn't know about who grew up with family where their parents were present, they were educated, they were aware, and they started their children at a level that I didn't even see. So when it came to running this race that we call life, they started so far ahead of me by their family structure that I couldn't even see where they were, let alone catch up to them. And this is, I believe, is the message that I'm hearing on all these podcasts, that there are many people who feel like life has been unfair because of birth. And, you know, how do we overcome that? For me, it was in education and in being curious. And it was in writing. And my magnum opus was ultimately my novel that I wrote when I published it last year. But it was about that very theme of running behind everybody else. And how do we catch up? And sometimes we never do, but we have to keep running. That's the key.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's very true. You know, they have that phrase, accident of birth. And sometimes, you know, is the accident you're born into a life of luxury, or is it that you're born into a family that struggles? And it's a powerful phrase. I think another superpower is having the capacity to dream and imagine a life larger than you, the life that you're living, if you want to have a different job or a different way of living, or maybe go to Florida all the time, live in Florida instead of just visiting once a year, once every 5 years. So curiosity and dreaming, those two, I think, are incredible superpowers. I would love to hear about the work you're doing. You know, the work you're doing for your nonprofit is incredible work. I would imagine it's not easy work every day. How did you even come to understand that this was something you were supposed to do?
And that almost goes back to my fundamentalist days when you look for God to tell you specifically every step. And I found that life is much more gray than that. And sometimes you have to take steps in the dark. So we had this old house we bought. It was 140 years old. And I started remodeling it. And I promised my wife I'd have it ready in 4 months. 14 years later, we're still remodeling. Total gut. And in the middle of it, we were living in it. And luckily, the kids were grown. But we were going to address the people who came to our door, and we could never help them. So we were going to use our house as a shelter. And we started doing that. And we brought one man from prison who was coming home without anywhere to go. And immediately the neighborhood erupted. And it became, there were petitions, there were threats, there were council meetings, there were ordinances passed. At one point, over the next several years, this occurred. We fought for years to allow people to come from prison and to offer them temporary shelter. At one point, I had police protection going to a council meeting. So, but eventually, we ended up suing the city, and we won. But more important, those same people today who were critics and petitioners 20 years ago, now, I like to say they wave at us with all their fingers. they're not supporters, but they accept, not grudgingly, but willingly accept what we do. And we've grown from our one house. We now have, we're buying our 20th house as we speak. And we will have, on any given day, we'll have more than 100 people in our houses in three different counties. And we've helped in some level more than 2,500 men and women in the past 24 years.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, first of all, thank you. Doesn't even begin to express how I feel about the work that you're doing. I think one of the things I was thinking was, you know, you begin this endeavor, you're remodeling your house, you want to do good works in the world. You want to be present however you can and lift other people up. I'm sure you never anticipated the blowback from the community. It must have been shocking.
I'm innocent when it comes to politics. I was totally taken aback because I spoke to a reporter because I simply wanted to share the news and to elicit support on some, not money necessarily, but just emotional support. And it was the exact opposite. Exact. So now I've learned to keep my head down and my mouth shut. Let my feet do the talking.
Right. I mean, honestly, the work you're doing is work that is essential. It's so needed. So many of these people need that transition housing because I would imagine that leaving prison and just being dumped out on the streets is utterly, you know, if you've been in prison for a long time, disorienting, a little, you feel like the ground isn't even underneath your feet. And how do you assimilate back into society? So in each of these houses, do you have counselors? Do you have teachers? Do you have, how do you help them transition?
The biggest thing my wife says I tend to do is try to do too much, put too much in the back of the truck. So what I decided to do was what is the need that I can do? We can offer housing. So we have we partner with the Department of Correction, and we don't charge our residents, but the Department of Correction will pay us per diem. And so we're able to pay our bills and to buy these houses and to run them with that per diem, because the data was very clear from the University of Cincinnati, a protracted study they did, that housing is the most important element in rehabilitation. Exactly what you said. If you get out, you've got to have a place where you can lay your head, then you can get a job, then you can start to pay your child support, then you could reunite with your children, and then you can become rehabilitated. But it takes time. So we do one thing. We offer a safe, affordable, because it's free, housing to those coming from prison. And we do have structure. We have rules. It's not a lockdown. But we expect you to be a good neighbor within the house. That's our definition of rehabilitation.
I appreciate that, a good neighbor within the house. We need good neighbors on every block, in every city. We need good neighbors everywhere. So thank you for that, the work you're doing, and thank you for explaining it. I think that not everybody would choose this for their ministry. I guess, how did you feel called to doing it? It's such a singular ministry.
I hesitate to use the term called. It implies that it's somehow ordained, but I think because I had failed in so many areas that I looked around and I said, are there people who have failed at more areas than me? Maybe, because if you're successful, if you've gone through high school and college and you've become by the time you're 30, you started Microsoft, you're not going to see people who are struggling. It's a long view. But in my perspective, it's not that far away. I've been homeless. I've been struggled. I've been thrown, I've been thrown out of better bars than this one. So I have an intimate understanding, but that doesn't mean I want to deify and dignify what it means to be homeless. It's homeless. There's nothing noble about being poor. It's just poor.
I also wanted to just thank you for having grit and determination and a backbone, because the fact that you had to have protection going to council meetings means that people were maybe a little bit unhinged and really could not even consider or understand the intention of the work that you were doing. And so thank you for not giving up.
I just read a piece today about Nelson Mandela. He was the president of Africa after having spent, I believe, 27 years in prison. And he was with his aide, and they were in a restaurant. He was president of South Africa. And there was a man at a table in that restaurant that was very, very nervous, and he was shaking. And Nelson Mandela said to the aide, That man is the former warden of my prison, and he was an evil, vile man who tortured me without conscience for years and years. And now he believes, he's convinced that I'm going to now torture him. And the aide said, what are you going to do? He said, I'm going to forgive him, because if I don't, I'm back in prison again. And that, to me, that was the lesson I took out of all the conflict, was that if I hold on to it like Velcro, then I will never get past this. But I had to become Teflon and simply let it fall off and keep my eyes on that prize. And that was probably my training under Dr. King's, not direct teaching, of course, but indirect teaching, that the only force that we can return is love force. And that sounds simplistic, but it's the day-to-day. For me, it was taking a snowblower and cleaning every sidewalk on my block, including my critics, because I didn't have to say a word, but I spoke volumes with the snowblower.
Yeah. Yes. And I'm actually thinking now of several people that, or situations I need to forgive. So thank you for reminding me. I think sometimes we can walk around with these kind of things that we are unable to let go of. And if we just sat still and approached it with love and forgiveness, we could release ourselves from the prison that we're putting ourselves into. I think, you know, one of the most important people we need to forgive is our own selves. I think we're so hard on ourselves in general in this world. And being able to say, hey, it's okay that you made that mistake, or hey, okay, so maybe that choice wasn't the best one, but you learned something. To have a little more compassion for ourselves would be super helpful in general in the world.
There's a phrase I use over and over again in my book. It's a story of Daniel Robinson and his journey. And he comes from this background and he's struggling to find forgiveness and love. And he's taught by his mentor, who says to him that life is not written in ink. It's written in pencil. And we get a lot of second chances. And that ultimately is Daniel's salvation, learning to forgive himself and forgive others. Because if he doesn't, everybody dies. Now, I think my theory is that the reason these podcasts have had such a positive response is that we're looking desperately for hope in this age today. People are looking for a reason to believe in something beyond themselves that's not angry and it's not violent. And they want to have a communal experience instead of a tribal exclusionary experience.
There's an icon that I especially love, and I've talked about it on the podcast, because I love art. I love beauty. I love art from all over the world, especially since I grew up all over the world. But there's this Catholic icon that has always just resonated with me and is so exquisite. And it's three people. They look like women and they're sitting at a table, but the front of the table, there's no one sitting there. And someone explained to me once, oh, well, that's the place for you. They're sitting there waiting for you. They're welcoming you in. They're beckoning you. There is a place for you at this table. And I think people want to hear those words, that they're welcome, that they can belong, and that they need community. The community is so good for us. You know, it feeds our hearts. So thank you for that point. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I wanted to share a quick anecdote. We had a man who came to us in 2009 or so, one of our first residents, and he was already, I think he was 67 years old, and he was schizophrenic, so he had issues, plus he had legal issues, and he was in and out of our houses, and he stayed by and large for 14 years with us, because when he came to us the last time, he was on the street freezing and near death because he had nowhere to go. And he stayed with us for 14 years. And when he eventually died, at one point he told us this was the only home he ever had. So that his name was Jimmy. And that gave an embodiment to what we are doing, is that there is a whole world filled with Jimmys. And they're unlovable, and we can't clean them up until we take them in and just accept them where they are. And then eventually they will find a home with us. and then they'll change. And he became, you and I would call it civilized, but he became safe. He felt safe.
John, you can anecdote with me all day long. I will accept all of your anecdotes. I love them. And also a really powerful story about the challenges that so many of us have accepting people where they are. And it doesn't mean they're going to stay there forever, but maybe they need a helping hand. Maybe they need $5. Maybe they need $100. Maybe they just need to be told that they look beautiful that day. Maybe they need a cup of coffee. The need is going to be different in so many places. Yeah. But I think you're using the word safe is so important, because I think a lot of people don't feel safe in today's world, whether they have a home or not, whether it's what they hear on the TV or the radio, whether it's, you know, what's going on in their family. And we can all be of service and be there for each other in different ways. We just have to see the opportunity, I guess, and be non-judgmental about it. So thank you. Thank you for that anecdote. I loved it. It's
unfortunately
powerful.
There are many people who try to verbally convince people to change. And so we talk at people instead of just shut up. My best sermons are the ones that I say nothing.
Well, I'd love to get to the meat of the podcast, the central question, which is, I would love for you to share any stories. It can be one story, it can be two stories, it can be five stories, whatever you feel comfortable sharing about something in your life where you feel like you witnessed something magical or miraculous, mysterious even, something that changed your life. I'd love to hear whatever you want to share.
Well, I'd like to say there was a magical moment. And that would make it much easier, because and the church is filled with that, where you have this Damascus Road experience, and then your life is forever was dark, now it's light. But I have found that life is a series of minor, seemingly minor decisions, and sometimes it's doing the right thing simply because it's the right thing without any response, as happened to us. We did what we thought to be the right thing, invested what few dollars we had, and it blew back right in our face. And we were facing years of litigation. But in fact, what we did in the middle of that was, right in the middle of litigation, we bought another building just to prove to ourselves that we would not back down on what we felt to be the right thing to do. And so I would say that it comes back to that we said originally, being curious, is that when you try a new road, even though it's frightening. Now, the downside is all these roads that I've taken, my children in many ways had to pay the cost for that, because they moved from school to school, state to state, while they were growing up. So just to show how life tends to heal itself. Today, my daughter works for an enterprise corporation. She's had the same job for 20 years in the same town. My son is a police sergeant in the same town, the same house, and he's been there 25 years. So they have become the stable persons that I could not be. So I was the transition for them to become stable. And so I feel like that gave me I look at my kids and I say, if I do nothing else, I gave my kids a better starting place. And they both have college education. So and my grandkids now, we're able to help them go to college. So they can see the starting line much better than I could.
It goes back to what we're talking about, or what we were talking about earlier, about accident of birth. You know, here you are, you grow up in this mill town, and you have all the trials and tribulations, triumphs of your life. And even though a lot of it was struggle to set up this nonprofit and having the blowback from the community, still you persevered, still you did not give up. And still you raised children that are successful, that are embedded within their communities, that are positive forces within their communities. But not only that, your grandchildren are now, you know, set up for success. And their accident of birth was, is being the grandchild of someone who's a force of nature, frankly. I mean, I'm like, how do we describe John? I think one could be force of nature because you don't back up or you don't back down and you don't give up. And that kind of strength is needed to create real positive change in this world. So thank you.
I've been looking at the political scene now for the past several years, and without taking position here, what I observe is the politicians who seem to be looking for which way is the wind going and how do I bend to the wind so that I can go with the direction of whatever that may be. And they go like this. And I have found that when it comes to making a courageous decision or a hard decision, you don't suddenly make the right decision. It comes from a long series of minor decisions where you do the right thing in small ways. So that's why I just finished a Substack article today where basically I concluded was your vote Tuesday may not change the world, but what you do in your corner of the world day to day will likely change your corner of the world. And so we look for political heroes, we look for strong men, but the truth is that it takes one little step today. And what you and I are doing is we're trying to make a difference somewhere, somehow, in a small way.
Yes, that is absolutely true. And I did want to say that story about Jimmy, for me, when you were telling that story, I thought, oh, dear, this is so beautiful and magical that you could be present to this individual who is struggling so deeply and be a source of support and safety for him, but also letting him know that you weren't going to abandon him, that you weren't going to say, hey, you know, we give up. Because I think so many people these days, if it doesn't go right, the first 5 minutes, 10 minutes, hour, day, they just walk away and they say, forget it. I'm giving up. And you did not. And so for me, that story is amazing.
One of the things, I have 10 staff now, and one of the things that I really work with is trying to teach them that our residents will absolutely fail you. They'll absolutely break a rule, or they'll break a promise, or they'll go back. They will fall down. But we have to not look for ways to catch them. We have to look for ways to help them get back up again. And because anybody can say you're fired, anybody can say you have to leave, you failed. But if it's hard to say, I know you failed, but I'm still going to be here for you. And I think that's why when we started particularly in the city of Dayton, Ohio, where most of our houses are located, we started there 20 years ago, and there were 20 other nonprofits like ours, and they're all gone. Well, ours is the only one remaining, and I believe it's because of that philosophy, is that we have been consistent with trying to help people and not just do a head count.
Wow, those numbers are kind of unbelievable. Wow. And to think that you navigated all this through COVID, and I mean, I can't even believe what that must have been like.
That was tough. That was tough. And ironically, even something so mundane as bed bugs, they were constantly, because people on the street bring in issues. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have to, I never even heard of the word bed bug. It's just a little slogan, sleep tight, don't let the bed bugs bite. Well, now I know that they do bite if you live on the street. So I've learned so many things in my own life about the issues that people face on the street.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to just say I'm grateful for the work you're doing in the world. And I'm grateful that these people who are transitioning from prison to society have you in their corner. We all need someone like you in our corner. Whether we are transitioning from prison or not, we all need someone like you in our corner. So thank you.
Oh, listen, I feel humbled that I even pinch myself that I say, you know, how do we get here? I can't even imagine it when I was living in my truck and when it was repossessed when I was single, how we have 20 houses and how do we have 10 staff? I feel I'm humbled by it. And I feel very honored to be where I am.
Gosh, thank you, John. You are the consummate guest. And I love your points of view. I love the way you relate to the world and how you interpret the world. And I love that you really model for me what resilience looks like, not only for your community and your family, but for these people who are in these. Oh my gosh, you're laughing. What does that mean? What does that mean?
My philosophy is that, you know, it's not like I have nowhere else to go. This is the bottom of the rung. This is the last job for me. And I've said, this is, nobody else is here. It's like at the Alamo, they drew a line in the sand and it said, all those who want to be heroes step across the line and everybody else stepped back. Mm-hmm. So it looked like I stepped forward and I didn't, I just stood there. So that's where I am. I'm at the Alamo.
Everyone, I hope that you loved meeting this stellar human being and hearing a little bit about his life, his experiences, and I hope that you reveled in his storytelling as much as I did. Suffice it to say, here is another human being who's bringing a whole lot of beauty into this world. And I think hearing stories like John's and hearing about people's lives and how they can inhabit so many different roles, well, I think that gives us all permission to be chameleons, to be agile, to change vocations when necessary. We don't all have to be just one thing, like a journalist or a counselor or even a fireman. Throughout our lives, we can do and engage with many different things. So I love John David. I feel like he just gave me permission to maybe, I don't know, go back to graduate school or something. That's the danger of interviewing these guests. I get really, really big ideas. To learn a little bit more about John David and his incredible book, Running as Fast as I Can, there will be a link in the episode's show notes. Because, oh yeah, did I forget to mention? John David is also an author. Thanks to all of you who listen to this podcast. If you feel it in your heart, in your bones, that you want to give me a rating or leave a little review, I would be ever so grateful. Those ratings and reviews help other people find us. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like John David. You already know what I'm going to say. Be a chameleon. Dream big, live large, imagine huge, imagine bigger than you could ever, ever think. Because you are the architect of your life. You are the one that gets to design the paths that you take, the roads that you travel. So if you want to be a fireman, if you want to be a park ranger, if you want to be an astronomer, go out and do it. Be a chameleon, be flexible, be open to the dreams the universe has for you. And I'm pretty sure that you'll look around one day and you'll look back at your life and you will realize that you lived it with courage, with fortitude, and with a whole lot of gorgeous grace.